Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 335 of the podcast. It's Saturday, 19th of August, 2017, as I record this. Today, I'm talking with Australian author John Birmingham about his journey from the dizzying heights of the traditional publishing scene at its heyday when authors were paid tons of money, to deciding to go indie and hybrid, and his insights into how the industry has changed. It's an honest and really fascinating interview, so I hope you enjoy that. So before we get into the usual introductory section, I want to acknowledge that it's been a hell of a week in the news and the media noise is particularly loud right now. And this is not a political show, but it's hard to escape the downward spiral of worry and fear at many of the things going on. And this does affect our creativity and our writing. And, you know, I've certainly found myself waking up and checking the news and then just, you know, being very upset about things. And it's affected, I know it's affecting a lot of us in terms of worry and fear and, yeah, and not writing when we should be writing. And very concerning. And again, this is not a political show, but my personal stance is clear and I want to acknowledge it. My family is multicultural and mixed race. My sister-in-law is Nigerian. My other sister-in-law is Canadian. My brother-in-law is Black British of Caribbean descent. And my niece is mixed race. My husband is Hungarian Jewish New Zealander. And his grandparents actually met after escaping the Nazi camps after the war. So I absolutely stand against any ultra-right-wing nationalists who claim white superiority. And in fact, I was thinking of Martin Niemöller poem about, you know, first they came for the socialists and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the, you know, all the people and eventually they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. And if they come for my family, I'm going to. So basically, I've been feeling this very in quite a sensitive manner and I wanted to share that, even though this is not a political show. But sometimes things just get too much, but it's a difficult time. And I was thinking about what we can do as creatives with the anger that we have and our need to express ourselves, because losing days arguing in Facebook rants is not enough. And it won't change people's opinion, actually. Arguments on Twitter and all the stuff that goes on there, I've just kind of stepped back from that. But we are writers and we can use our voices through our stories. And stories slip behind people's prejudices, which can be much more effective and powerful. To quote Toni Morrison, this is precisely the time when artists go to work. There is no time for despair, no place for self-pity, no need for silence, no room for fear. And I'll link to you that article in the show notes. And you know, I think for me, I write people of different cultures into my books, as well as, you know, and people of different religions, as well as different races, as well as, you know, women and men. I haven't had a transgender person yet, but I have, you know, lesbian couples and gay people and, you know, just generally just put people into your books. We don't have to bash the reader over the head with identity. It's just who these people are. And when I think about my niece growing up, I want to write mixed race strong women for her to see in her future. So yeah, these are the types of things we need to do is really write into our stories, take our anger and our fear for collective futures and write and create something that will touch another person and maybe, just maybe, change their mind. I realized, and it's funny, when we write a book, often we might not necessarily realize some of these things are behind it, but I wrote the author's note for the map book this weekend and realized how much of my anger is channeled into the story. You know, on the one hand, it's a fantasy quest, and, you know, has lots of my usual action adventure and that type of thing. But it's also about borders and walls and judgment of the other and refugees and Brexit and nationalism and how I am not choosing to give up my European identity. It is being taken from me. And these are, you know, that's just one emotional response to some of the huge issues facing our world. But sometimes the only way we can manage our own emotional struggle is by writing. And so I hope that kind of helps you with the noise that's going on right now and the many things that are being talked about. This is an interesting time in history, that's for sure. Okay, enough said, back to the show. So in publishing this week, and also, I mean, I guess this type of thing puts some of our other issues into perspective. And this is another reason I really like walking for long periods of time, because everything starts falling into perspective. But there, you know, coming back to some of the minutiae of the self-publishing life, of which we all worry about too. So there have been a few articles about KDP Select in the last week, as usual. David Gochran has been reporting on scammers and click farms taking over the charts. But then separately, David has reported on how one of his own KDP Select promotions was impacted by a mistake by another site and how inadequate Amazon's response was. And I'll link to that in the show notes. Then the latest KENP rate was announced. And although the fund grew, the per page rate dropped. It is, you know, around 0.004 US dollars per page, which if you calculate that on a sort of 300 page novel, it's not very much money. So, you know, many people say, oh, it's like 4 cents a page. No, it's 0.004 per page, which is about 0.0031 GBP. And I'll link to the digital reader on this. There've been a few reports this week of authors deciding that they would leave Select because it keeps trending downwards and it's obviously harder to make a living. Now, my thoughts on this you are not owed a living as a writer. I'm sorry, but no one said this was easy. But what job is easy and what life is a bed of roses? And in fact, making a living with your writing is a challenge. But we have more choices than ever as authors to get our words into the hands of a growing pool of readers. And we have more opportunities every day. But you get to choose whether you take advantage of those opportunities. So yes, it's much harder to go wide than it is to just stay on Amazon, but you get to choose whether you are exclusive. I choose to be wide or publish on other sites for most of my books, for most of Joanna Penn and JF Penn. After we have 5 books under the Sweet Romance name, I will be going wide with that. So that will probably be spring 2018. We'll go wide with the Sweet Romance, and I'm going to announce the name at some point too. We all have to build the future we want to be a part of. So this kind of cycles back to the political arena, but you know, the choices we make affect the future that happens. So if all indie authors choose to be exclusive on Amazon, then Kobo Writing Life won't thrive. And, you know, neither will companies like Draft Digital, you know, opportunities like Publish Drive and on Google Play or iBooks, all these different things that we have. If you want a thriving ecosystem where other vendors can challenge Amazon, then you need to support those vendors by selling there as well. And yeah, I think this is one of these long-term, short-term decisions that's really hard, because clearly if you're making decent money on Amazon by being exclusive, then you can say, well, you know, I'm just going to do that, make X amount of money and then go wide. Fair enough, that's your choice. I'm just thinking about the wider effect of some of the choices we make in the short term. So if you choose to be exclusive, don't moan about the per page rate. That's your choice. You can pull out and be elsewhere and grow an audience at the other stores. Okay, gosh, I'm a bit of a rant today. Turning into Jim Cookroll at the Selma Book Show. But yeah, these are some of the things I'm thinking about and I feel like I have a stance on some of these issues. Anyway, my personal update, I have been editing the MacBook this week and I tweeted a picture on Twitter. It's basically a mass of ink on the page and it's the messiest first draft I've done in a long time. Comparing it to End of Days, my last novel, I pretty much printed out that first draft, edited it, and it was pretty publishable on first draft, to be honest. It needed some line edits and proofreading, but it was almost pristine. And I can't work out what the problem with this MacBook is. It's either because it's a new series, a new world with new characters in a new genre, and I don't know what I'm doing, or whether it's because I dictated most of it and my speaking voice is different to my writing voice and I wasn't almost cycling, as Dean Wesley Smith says. When I type, I'm almost cycling and cleaning up my sentences as I go. I've noticed a lot of passive voice, for example, with my dictation, which is very annoying because if you write passively, you then have to rewrite actively and it changes the whole sentence structure, which is good, but it means a lot of writing, rewriting. Plus, there's a lot of stream of consciousness where I you know, there's one section I dictated while I was walking along the canal path. And that's taking a lot of rewriting because I'm just going off on some tangent about the foliage. It's just not necessary. Anyway, so it's a hard edit, but I'm going to go for another week and then get it to my story editor, Jen, who's great, and will come back with a whole load of comments that will help me clean it up. Then I'll do another round of line edits. So I'm hoping to get it out by Christmas. That's the plan. I am back into thinking it will be a trilogy or maybe even an ongoing series, as there are some bigger story arcs. I mean, the book is a self-contained story, but there's a much bigger world to explore and a lot more that could happen to the characters. And I guess that's how fantasy works, because it can be such a big and interesting world. So yeah, looking forward to finishing that one. I'm also in the rewrite on the third Sweet Romance. And that will be out in early October. And as ever, if you like contemporary, clean and wholesome, sweet romance with a happy ever after, nothing political, nothing, no swearing, no violence, just a nice happy time. And, you know, to be fair, I'm really enjoying the rewriting of those books because they're just happy, happy. And I completely get why people love to sink into romance and just have a nice time. So if you're interested in a review copy of any of the Sweet Romance, please email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. And I always have review copies of those because we're growing the audience. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Monica Rodriguez says, listening while waiting for a traffic jam to clear and sent a picture of geese crossing the road, which is very cute. L.E. Thomas says, great show this week. You made the back to school traffic bearable. A.R. Robinson says, cooking in my Parisian Airbnb while listening to the best-selling Christian author on your podcast. Monumental time for me. Glad you enjoyed the interview with Jerry. Amy Cesari says, harvesting the first pumpkin and doing a brisk walk on the treadmill before I sit down at my ergonomically correct writing desk for the rest of the day, which is fantastic. And finally, Rian says, thank you for making more of your backlist available through the podcast apps. I've been training for my first 5K and listen to you while I run. I had run out of episodes, but now there are plenty. Yes, and thanks to everyone who's been saying they're listening to the backlist. Since I upped how many were available on the feed, you can now get a lot more on your device. So yeah, listen to the backlist and hear my career in reverse. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and we have a new batch of audios from Mark. So I'll play a word from them in a minute and it will be a new one, which is very exciting. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Sharon Holmes, JC Henry, Mark Middlebrook, Shannon Sinclair, Deirdre Riordan Hall, Rochelle J. Christensen, and Karen, who creates the End of Life University, which for someone like me sounds very interesting. You know, I'm fascinated by the death culture which is, you know, becoming far more accepting of the inevitable end of life. So thanks to everyone who supports the show on Patreon. Like your tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And also, I have recorded the extra monthly Q&A for August, and I'll be back into doing September in a couple of weeks. You can get the extra Q&A recordings, which are now, there's tons of them, there's like 2 years worth now, if you're desperate for more of my voice, or just Q&As on writing and publishing and marketing, check those out. You can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you fancy. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Kobo, and then we will get into the interview.
Hey everyone, it's Mark Lefebvre, director of Kobo Writing Life, and I'm here to tell you how authors are still able to use free to both up their sales as well as to gain new readers. You can listen all about it on the Kobo Writing Life podcast, episode 88 at kobowritinglife.com. I know we're not as cool or as fun as your dynamic host, Joanna Penn, but we're trying to be. One day, we may grow up and be as awesome as she is. But we do have some fun content on the Kobo Writing Life podcast and on the Kobo Writing Life website at kobowritinglife.com, where we have articles and podcasts that focus on the craft and business of writing. But speaking of your awesome host, let's get back to her now, shall we?
Today, I'm here with John Birmingham. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
How are you doing, buddy? It's been a while.
I know. Well, thanks for coming on. Just a little introduction. John is an award-winning and best-selling Australian author of science fiction, techno-thriller, crime, urban fantasy, memoir, and non-fiction. His latest non-fiction book is How to Be a Writer Who Smashes Deadlines, Crushes Editors, and Lives in a Solid Gold Hovercraft, which sounds awesome. Now, John, I first heard of you when I moved to Brisbane, Australia, back in 2007. And actually, if people don't know, you're actually an Australian icon with your book He Died with a Falafel in His Hand, which is iconic. So tell us a bit about how did your publishing career get started and what was the industry like back then?
Look, it was I was a late starter. I always wanted to write, but what I most wanted in life was to write feature articles for magazines. I saw myself jetting off around the country, jetting off around the world, having these adventures, writing stories about it, and being paid, I don't know, $5 a word by magazines like Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair. And I got it all except for the $5 a word. I started writing in the fringe press, student magazines and street press. And you know what? If you've got people who are looking to get published, who aren't like desperately just trying to do books, they just want to get into print, they want to be edited, maybe they want to get paid, or, you know, at least a food voucher sort of backhanded to them by an editor, then street press, fringe press, that sort of thing, they're, you know, websites, they're not bad places to start. They get your work into a deadline, and some of them, even now, some of them still do pay. So I did that for about 10 years or so. And I got to the point where I was a very successful freelancer. I could ring up the editor of pretty much any magazine in the country that I wanted, and I could pitch them a story. They would usually, you know, send me $1,000 for expenses, and I'd fly off and I'd do the story. It was actually pretty good, but I was kind of slow. One of my editors, Max Such at the Independent Monthly, described me as chiseling my pieces out on stone tablets, and it wasn't far wrong. So despite the fact that I had like worked my way into this fantastic position where I could commission my own stories effectively, I think I was making about 10 or 12 grand a year. And I just, anybody who's worked in newspapers or magazines will have worked for a newspaper or a magazine that's died. It's just what happens, and particularly nowadays. And I had a period where just a bunch of mags I worked for fell over, a bunch of editors I submitted to moved on, and I suddenly found myself with just one paying gig, which was pretty tenuous. And I walked into that gig one day. It was the Independent Monthly. It was a fantastic magazine, very, very classy, really high production values, proper editing. Like by the time you finished a story for those guys, you couldn't. I remember trying to. I had to get a quote from Robert Hughes, the art critic, once to put into a story because he was in town. They said, "I get one from Hughes here to be good." So I got a great quote from him. Do you think I could break this story open to just shoehorn it in? I couldn't because these guys had edited it so perfectly, and that was good training for later on about, you know, knowing the importance of editing. Anyway, I came into the mag one morning and I could smell it. It's on the air, and I just went, death. I can smell death. And I went to the editor, or the deputy editor, actually, Michael Duffy. I said, "Michael, is that death I smell?" And Michael was like, "It's death, it's death, it's death." And so he said, look, we got to get out. And he was setting up a little publishing company, and he wanted a stocking stuffer for Christmas, just a funny book that he could hopefully sell a couple of hundred copies of. Mm. And I said, "Mate, I've got a couple of flatmate stories I could write for you. Why don't I do that?" So he gave me, you know, a small advance, and I gave him a small book. And it, to tell you the truth, Joanna, it died. It died almost as badly as that magazine when it came out. And it looked like for about 6 months, like Michael had done his dough. He'd mortgaged his house to set up this company, and he was going to do his dough cold. But then for some reason, it started to sell and it started to move by word of mouth. This is all pre-internet, pre-email, pre-mailing lists, pre-social media. This is old school publishing.
What year and, was this? This
would have been 96. As a sort of an example of the really awful ideas we had for publicising this book, because it was about share housing. I'd had about 100 flatmates by this point, and they'd all been disastrous. And Michael got me to bring in all of my unwashed socks and underpants, and he'd somehow secured these biohazard bags from a nearby hospital, and into each bag went like either a dirty sock or a pair of unwashed underpants and a copy of the book, and then they got mailed out to the literary editors of Australia, who surprisingly enough were just not that interested. So when that didn't work out, he then had me walking around the inner city of Sydney pushing copies of this book under the doors of houses that looked like they might be occupied by, you know, people in share housing. And I don't think either of those things worked for us, but at some point, I don't know, somebody read a copy and told a friend, and that's how you sold books in those days. The magic, the arcane, scary, fateful magic of word of mouth. And it took off and actually became a phenomenon. I honestly don't know how many copies it's sold now. I know it's in excess of 500,000. In fact, came out in the UK at one point and did very well there, did a couple of print runs. And it was weird. Like I wrote that book as a favour for him. And I didn't write it wanting to break into publishing. It was a favour for Michael and a way to just put a couple of bucks in my kit bag while I look for some other freelance work. And it just completely changed the direction of my life, which has actually been the story of my life in publishing. It's had a few sort of course corrections like that weren't exactly planned.
Wow, it's so interesting. And I've been interviewing a few people lately who've had these books that they didn't expect to be bestsellers and didn't. And I think this is the thing. So many writers sit there trying to craft the book that's going to change their life and change their career. And yet, you know, even someone like J.K. Rowling didn't know what Harry Potter would be. And what you've said there, like you didn't know that that would be the book that would, I think, fair to say, made you famous in Australia and thus has led to other books in your career. So talking about pivotal moments, you then obviously have gone on to write tons and tons of other books. But, you know, the reason I wanted to talk to you was in 2016, you announced that you were going hybrid, as in you were going to self-publish some of your books. And when I was living in Brisbane, I considered you part of the literary establishment. And I was like, I was a new...
What, if I snub you at an event or something?
Probably. But it was, you know, you didn't have that feeling back when I lived there, sort of mid-2000s, 2006, you know, 2007, that was something that you would consider. So why did you go hybrid in 2016? What's changed?
Look, the long story short, I desperately needed to. Long story long, I'd been looking at ebooks for a while. Like the trade publishing business, which, you know, the big old houses that have been around for centuries in some cases, it didn't always have the sort of fear and loathing of ebooks that it currently has. When they first came out, it was kind of interesting. Like it was another income stream, and they figured, you know, you suddenly sort of weren't dealing with the grittiness and friction of having to, you know, put books into boxes and put them on trucks and send them all the way, you know, around the country. And everyone was quite excited by it. And quite a few of the trade houses set up these sort of in-house units, which were devoted only to doing ebooks. And so, you know, everybody was looking at it as an exciting new opportunity. There were suddenly forms of writing which were selling digitally, which hadn't sold before. I remember talking to my agent, Russ, in New York, and he said he was suddenly getting all this money in that he just couldn't figure out where it was coming from. And what it was the publishers had bundled together bunches of old short stories by some of his literary authors, and they just put them out as books, and no publicity, no marketing, just dropped it into the channel. But there were so many of these things happening that it was suddenly becoming like a significant amount of money flowing into the trade houses. And then, of course, you know, the industry began to shake itself out, and it got into a quite serious confrontation, I guess, with Amazon, who still is, like, you know, the sort of the elephant in the room with ebook publishing. And they have now found themselves in a position where I think, to be honest, if they could wave a magic wand and just make ebooks go away, they would. I think they just really prefer they weren't around. But I was part of that business at that point, and I was as excited by everyone. And the thing which really excited me about ebooks was, you know, I write these I eventually moved into thriller writing and doing long series, and I tended to write in trilogies, and I built big worlds and populated them with lots of characters. And the thing that really intrigued me about ebooks was the possibility to write stories just off the page. You know, you would have the experience of having fans and readers email you or contact you on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, say, oh, you know, that character who was like a minor character in some story, they really like them and they want to know what's going to happen with them, but you know, nothing's going to happen with them because, you know, that was just something you wrote to move, you know, the main character from page 57 to page 58. But for whatever reason, some reader, often quite a few readers, are deeply invested in this small character. And the thing that intrigued me about ebooks was the possibility of investigating the story lives of those characters away from the main plot. And that's all I wanted to do. What I discovered very quickly was that writing ebooks for trade publishers is a mug's game, because you put as much effort into them as you do with a novel. But just because of the way the numbers fall, you don't make a living out of it. In fact, you probably, to be truthful, you lose money writing ebooks. And I got to a place where I could think about it in terms of, oh, look, I'll write these ebooks as fan service and as relationship management with the publishers, but I'm not going to do them as a business, because doing ebooks for publishers, that's not a business. That's madness, mate. Absolute madness. Anyway, so that was the background to it. And I at this stage, I had publishers in the UK, the US, Australia, a couple of other places, but the three big English language markets were the main ones. And I'd always managed to keep them in a sort of uneasy balance over the years. And my American publishers came up with this idea for a franchise character, an urban fantasy, the Dave Hooper series. Mm. They wanted me to write a character that I could just keep writing for years. So I came up with one. It was a I really loved those books, actually. At that point, they were the best books I'd ever written. And they were really funny. They were the first determinedly humorous books I'd written since Falafel and Tassie Babes. We had this deal where they were all supposed to come out, I think it was like April 2014 or April 2015. Anyway, April. And it would have been, you know, not on the same day, but pretty much in the same week. And what that does, it means that if you do a chat with somebody like you, it has an effect in all the markets at the same time. So you get all these synergies in the marketing. And it just didn't work out. I got a call from my publisher, or my then publisher at my in Australia. It was about 2 or 3 days before Christmas, and they said, "Oh, look, we've got a lot of these books sitting in the warehouse." Because one thing I will give the Australian publishers, they're just ruthlessly efficient. They edit quickly, but they edit to really, you know, high global standards. They move quickly. They're a polished operation. What that meant was that they had thousands of these books, I guess, sitting in their warehouse, and they've got months before they can distribute them. And I guess some bank counter just went, "Nah, let's get them going, mate. Now I'm burning a hole in my pocket." And so they rang up and said, "We're going to put these out on Christmas Eve." I'm like, "What?" Because I don't know what it's like in the UK or the US, but you might recall from your time in Oz that Christmas Eve is that's when things shut down in this country. They shut down for at least a month.
Yeah, a month. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Everything closes because people are about to go away for their, you know, not just their Christmas break, but their yearly break, their summer break. Yeah. And they were probably thinking, we'll just, you know, people are on the beach. These are great beach books. We'll sell a few. No, you're not, because they dropped them into these bookstores on Christmas Eve when, you know, quite frankly, the booksellers are, they're exhausted. And honest to God, they're sick of the sight of books. They could happily never see another book as long as they live by the time Christmas Eve rolls around. And so that was kind of a disaster. There's no one working in media at that point. They're all just, you know, taking filler from the wire services. So I couldn't do any publicity for it. Mm. Worst of all, however, because the ebook came out at the same time as the trade paperback, most of my readers who were overseas, not in Australia, could see, oh, you know, JB's got a book out. But they couldn't get it because that book was geofenced within Australia. Mm. So it was also pretty expensive, as you'd imagine, because they now, you know, they price match between trade paperback and an ebook. And within, I don't know, a day, 2 days, it was all over the pirate sites, and, you know, you got thousands of copies just, you know, going everywhere. And so by the time my US and UK publishers released, it was dead. It was all over. Mm. It was a disaster. And I sort of won't go into the really grimy details of how everything went sideways hard and fast at that point, but it did. And I suddenly found myself with like nothing. I'd always been on contract. I'd always had like more books to look forward to. I was suddenly in dispute with at least my Australian publisher. I could see like 15, 20 years worth of work just swirling down the dunny, as we say down here. And the one thing I had in my back pocket was I had written a couple of ebooks. And again, I by this stage I'd wised up. I hadn't written them for money because I knew I wasn't going to make any money off them. I'd written them as fan service and relationship management with the publishers, which turned out to be a bit of a sick joke. So I just called them up and I said, "Yeah, I'll be taking those books back and I'll be doing them myself." Previously, my agent had not just advised me, but pretty much told me, "You won't be doing any indie publishing at all because the trade houses don't like it. They don't like their mid-list authors going and doing it. They'll put up with like their marquee authors doing it because those guys have got market power and they can get away with it. But if you're a mid-lister, like if you're selling anywhere between 10 and, I don't know, 30, 40, 50,000 copies, you're a fair chance, or you were a fair chance the last 5 or 6 years to get cut if they found that you'd gone off the reservation and done something for yourself. So, but I didn't have a choice. You know, I got kids, I got a mortgage. This is my job. It's, I have been a full-time writer since I was about 21 years old, and I'm now quite a bit older than that. So I had no other skills, and I spent about – I didn't just sort of charge into it. I spent about 6 months, maybe 8 months actually, researching. You know, I dived deep into your website and some of your books. I binge-listened Johnny, Dave, and Sean. Yeah. Everyone knows who we're talking about. I got their books. Dave Cochran's Let's Get Digital. I have read that, I think, 10 times, just cover to cover. Guido's book on how to code. I read that from cover to cover and realized I can't do this. So
luckily we have Vellum now, so
yeah, that's right. No, I got a hold of Guido. I said, you're just going to do these books for me. And so I sent him some money, and he actually laid out the first couple. But you're right, now this Vellum is a great example of how quickly things are moving in this sphere, because previously I had to allot a week to send a manuscript to New York and then get it back and check it and back and forth and back and forth. Now I came up with an idea for a book this afternoon as I was coming home. I'm just going to take all the fight scenes out of my previous novels and bundle them together and just call it Biff! Exclamation mark. And I'll be able to do that in about an hour. It just comes straight out of Word into Vellum, and, you know, an hour or so later on, I'll probably drop it into Pronoun and push it out. And I did spend a long time researching, and I used those two early books as experiments to prove the model. But everything that you guys had been, you know, writing and telling us about, it all worked pretty much as advertised. And this is the thing, I must admit, having come from trade publishing, which is a sort of genteel business in some ways and yet as ruthless as an assassin's guild in others, I found the sort of communitarian, like, you know, one for all and all for one culture of indie publishing to be not just refreshing but life-saving. I couldn't believe that you guys had done all this work and you were just sharing it. It was very, very strange. But I, you know, I've got the bug myself now. I just came back from a conference on the weekend, and I had a lot of like authors at the conference, still trade publisher, were sort of quietly sidling up and going, you know, this self-publishing thing, JB, how's that working out? And so, well, you know, you want to go check out Joanna's site, you want to go read Dave's book, you want to, you know, listen to Sean, Johnny, and Dave's podcast, or Dawson. Oh my God, Mark Dawson. I just, you know, if he's up for it, I'll have his babies, because that guy, I reckon, saved my bacon.
Oh, well, Mark listens to the show, so he'll be happy for the shout out. But thank you so much for sharing so honestly about why you moved, because I've been at conferences lately as well with quite big name authors in America and Britain, and a lot of them on the side will ask these questions about indie, but they won't do it in public and they won't necessarily talk about it because of this fear. And it was interesting, you said that the, you know, the mid-list going indie was frowned upon because they're the people who need it most. You don't need it as a debut and you don't need it as a big name, right? So that's kind of crazy. But how do you think the attitude is changing? I mean, I found coming back to Australia that it's almost got more snobby than it used to be. So how do you think this is going to shake out?
Badly for the publishers, quite well for the mid-list. It depends. If they're willing to do the work and, you know, spend a lousy $3 or $4, you know, buying Cochran's Let's Get Digital or you know, just invest a bit of time in the car listening to the, you know, God knows how many podcasts there are now. they will do well because they can write. There are, you know, the business model of trade publishing houses is you've got the whales and, you know, your J.K. Rowling's, your Stephen King's, your James Patterson's, sort of, and they make enormous amounts of money. And then you have mid-listers who traditionally have always made money. They just don't make enormous amounts. And then you have the bets that they're taking on the new entries, and they usually lose money. And, you know, a mid-lister can go from earning money to losing money, at which point they'll sort of slowly get eased out of the company. The problem for the trades going forward is that their big name authors have generally come from the mid-list. Like J.K. Rowling was not a huge and immediate success. She was very successful, but I recall being on book tour when I think she was maybe two books into the series, and I was going through a Borders, there were still Borders in Sydney at that point, and my publicist, the lovely Annie Coulthart, actually picked up a copy of one of the early Potters and said, oh, you should have a look at this, JP. This is really interesting. And she started saying, you know, this was a book that was supposed to be for kids, and we're just finding lots and lots of grown-ups are reading it too. And it's just, you know, it's possibly going to be like a bit of a phenomenon. So at that point, she was not, you know, J.K. Rowling, like the owner of castles and, you know, possible, you know, secret superhero fighting crime in her spare time. She was just a mid-lister who was, you know, very, very quickly becoming like a global cultural phenomenon. I interviewed Ian Rankin at I think Sydney Writers Festival a couple of years ago. Fantastic guy. We murdered three quarters of a bottle of whiskey on stage together. It was, if I remembered the night, I'm sure I'd remember it fondly. And he was, he said, you know, it took him seven books to break out. And so the model in the past has been that they will invest again and again and again in authors in whom they believe. And also, you know, to give them their due, they're book people. They love books. And I know of, you know, lots of really hard-nosed traditional publishers who just keep investing in books that they know in their hearts are not going to work because they feel in their hearts that these books should be published and they should be given to humanity forever. And that's, you know, that's admirable. It's just a model which, unfortunately, is increasingly difficult to justify under the sort of, you know, neoliberal economic regime we all suffer under nowadays.
And it doesn't pay your mortgage. Future,
no, that's right. In future, I suspect what will happen is it'll go one of two ways. Either they will just concentrate on what works for them. So massive franchises, obviously, you know, the new Twilights, the new Pottermores, that sort of stuff. And, you know, lots and lots of first-time authors because there's still real prestige to getting picked up by a trade house. And it really, it doesn't cost them that much to do. And they're certainly not spending the money on marketing. And in between, there'll be nothing. Because, you know, anybody who's been in the business for a couple of years begins to figure it out that, you know, they could do it themselves. You know, why would you in the end as a mid-list author, somebody who's got maybe what's the magic Nick Stevenson number, 10,000 readers, that's not a big mid-list readership. If you've got that many people, why would you settle for making 60 or 70 cents a book selling to them via a trade publisher when you could be making $4 or $5 a book selling to them directly yourself? And also, you know, as you would know, the amount of control you have over the process, the transparency from like just go to woe, it's incomparable. And I think either the trade publishing houses will have to accept the reality that their authors, their mid-list authors, who in the end of their future have to be allowed to go hybrid, or those mid-listers are just going to go off and do it for themselves.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'm so glad you've got the bug. I think you're a good ambassador for indie down under.
I love them both. I still publish with trades. I'm having a chat with quite a significant publisher in a couple of days about a couple of books that I came up with. And in fact, it's super hybrid in some ways, because one of the plans I had was, when I realized that trade publishers were just not interested in ebooks, I thought, well, if they don't want ebooks, maybe they could leave them to me. Mm. They can take the print and I will do the ebooks. But of course, that's not going to work out because of the difference in the price differential. But then it struck me, these guys are still, their business model, their global business model, is still stuck in the era of like sailing ships and sea chests full of straw and sturdy leather bound tomes. And so they still divide the world up into, British Commonwealth, US, Asia, Europe, whatever. And so it strikes me as, and this is something for any published author or even self-published author who's got a few runs on the board now, what you could look at doing is something I'm going to look at doing with a couple of these titles as an experiment, where I sell the print and ebook rights to a trade publisher in one area, and then just do it myself in another one. And that strikes me as a model you'll see a lot of in the next 10 years or so.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Whenever traditionally published authors come to me, the first thing I say is, what rights have you sold? And if you haven't sold World English, like, don't sell World English. It's crazy to do that. Like, sell by territory and then self-publish in other places. So that's awesome. So I want to ask you about those people listening who would like to sell more books in Australia. So, of course, Australia is around 25 million people, I think. So it's not a huge market. And, of course, they're not all the readers. That's all the people. But if people want to kind of market to Australians, do you have any sort of tips, or, you know, do people read on iBooks, or, you know, what have you found works for book marketing specifically in Australia?
iBooks is important in Australia in the same way that Kobo is important in Canada. I know from my own mailing list stats that, just looking at the in the back end, that I think about 55-60% of my subscribers have iOS devices, which means, you know, it doesn't mean they're all reading iBooks, but it means they're all potential iBooks readers. And iBooks as an entity, they're part of Apple, but they very much see themselves as independent within that sort of, you know, monstrous media corporation. They are desperate to knock a bit of skin off Amazon. And so, you know, if you have any way of, reaching out to them, I just talk specifically to people in Australia, and then I'll sort of talk to people overseas. If you're in Australia, maybe think about getting yourself to one of the big festivals, like Melbourne or Sydney or Adelaide, and tracking down the iBooks. They're going to be there, and introduce yourself and actually say, you know, I've sold a few books on your service, because you will have. It's a big part of the market here. And, you know, if you offer, say, a week's exclusivity on iBooks for a bit of space on the front page, if you've sold a few copies, you'll probably get it. Because iBooks is not like Amazon. The beauty of Amazon is that it's not a bookstore. It is a search engine for people with credit cards and no impulse control. And so the thing which appears on the front page for you at Amazon is the thing that Jeff Bezos thinks you are most likely to buy. And at iBooks, the things that appear on the front page, the same way as, you know, when you walk into a bookstore, it's the titles that have been organized to appear there. So you walk into a bookstore, some of your listeners will know this, but some of them won't. You walk into a bookstore and you see a great big stack of James Patterson's. They're not there because James Patterson's popular. I mean, that's part of the reason they're there. They're there because James Patterson publisher cut a deal with that bookstore, basically paid them to stack them up at the front. And there's, you know, very, very intricate and quite restrictive contracts between the publishers and the bookstores about, you know, which books go where. So, yeah, you should, if you are outside the US, you should definitely look at channels other than Amazon. And in Australia, iBooks is like super super important. The other stuff, though, all of the things which work in the US, the UK, Canada, wherever, they will all work here. So if you have a mailing list, then work your mailing list. If, I mean, as we know, that's really, that's technically a weapon that we all have. But, you know, you, if you have a social media presence, you can use that to target people down here. But realistically, as you know, like the ebook market, it's a global market. If you're not addressing the entire English-speaking market, then you're doing yourself a disservice. And apart from just the one thing with iBooks being important down here, there's nothing specifically that you would need to do in Australia that you wouldn't be doing anywhere else. If you've got your, you know, your readership, your mailing list, your social media game on point in the UK or in the US, it's going to work down here as well. Mm-hmm. It's these methods which you guys have all developed over the past 5 years, they work, and they work just as well here as they do anywhere else.
Mm. No, fantastic. Now, what is different is the print market in Australia in terms of right now, Amazon.com.au does not have print books. It has ebooks and audiobooks. But I've read that they have announced that they're going to set up a warehouse and that they are presumably going to attempt to disrupt the print market in Australia, which as a reader, I think is fantastic because books are still like 25, 30 Aussie dollars, which are really expensive. Yep. So, but then I kind of heard rumors that things were not working out so well. Do you know anything about the sort of print market and Amazon coming in and how that might change things?
Well, they're not just coming in to books. They'll probably come into books, but they do face significant headwinds in the book market here that they didn't necessarily face overseas, and I'll go into those. But my understanding with Amazon coming to Australia is they're bringing the whole wagon train. Mm-hmm. So it's not just books; it's white goods and food and clothes, fashion, electric. It's the lot, and so there is an enormous amount of terror being spread in the retail sector at this arrival. I'm sure that bookstores have their own feelings about it, but the digitization of the book market in Australia has been ripping ahead, possibly even faster than it has in the US and the UK. And that's partly just a function of the demographics and the geography of Australia. People are spread out everywhere. I know from touring in the country and the regional areas that there are hundreds of small towns without a bookstore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you want to buy like a physical copy of a book, unless your local newsagent carries them, you're out of luck. And the newsagent is only going to carry like, the absolute sort of top of the airport sort of novel stuff. And in that sense, Amazon coming, if they do come as a book distributor, which they probably will, that's a really good thing for most people who live outside the inner city in Australia because it means they suddenly have access to, you know, all those titles. Having said that, there are a couple of Amazon Lite local businesses here. There's this one group called Booktopia who are fantastic, and they have been ramping up and building out their giant robot book factories for a few years now. And everybody who publishes in Australia with trades has had the experience of going out to the Booktopia robot factory and just marveling at how these are probably going to enslave us one day. And I don't see those guys getting buried by Amazon in the same way that, say, Borders were buried by Amazon. The other thing to bear in mind in Australia is that independent bookstores did not die out here the same way that they did in like huge swaths of the US, and I'm not sure what the situation is in the UK, but over here, indies control, I think, about 40, maybe more than 40% of the print book market. And they're massively important. And like, you know, when I say independent books, I mean like a lot of small, often family-run operations who still hand sell. And, you know, they you get this very sort of fine granular control by a couple of people about what goes onto the shelf. So you go into this independent bookstore and you'll see these books. You go into that independent bookstore, you see a whole bunch of other books. They're, you know, they're very, very different. And it's actually one of the joys of working in this business in Oz, is that I know bookstores have struggled the same way that most businesses have struggled since 2008. But the ones who have survived and thrived have done so because they're just really, really good at what they do. And it's just a joy to go into a well-run indie bookstore, of which there are hundreds in Australia.
No, that's fantastic. Now, I could talk to you for ages. This is so interesting, but we are almost out of time. So I did want to ask just briefly about your book, How to Be a Writer, which, of course, my audience will be interested in. And particularly, you talk about multiple streams of income, because you do have books, but you also have a paid newsletter. You've been blogging for years. Just give us a bit of an idea as, you know, some of the other things that writers can be looking at in terms of multiple streams of income, and also what else people can find in that book.
Well, that book, there are lots and lots of books around about how to write, and I advise you, go read them, particularly if you haven't, you know, had the advantage that I had of being trained by brutal editors in the media for 10 years before I wrote my first book. So I didn't want to write one of those books. What I wanted to talk to people about was the business of being a writer, like how to chase up a check that's gone missing, as checks inevitably do when you deal with magazines, or how to do an interview. Like it's actually an important part of the research process, for instance. So what I wanted to do with that book was basically provide a tool bag for people who want to get into the business. So there's no advice about how to balance a sentence, or, you know, construct a narrative arc or anything like that. But there's lots of advice about how to chase, you know, delinquent editors who owe you $1,000 and that kind of thing. And one of the advice points I do make is, if you're going to make a living from writing, you need to be making it from lots of different sources, because it is a risky, contingent sort of business. I've written stories for magazines that have gone out of business. I've written stories for magazines some of them like big name publications, who basically had an unwritten policy of not paying people. You know, like they'd say they'd pay you and then they just stiff you. And so I was always a member of the journalists union when I was doing freelancing and feature writing, because I just put those mad dogs onto the job whenever a check went missing. Checks. I can't believe I'm talking about checks, mate. This is how long I've been in this business. I did my tax recently, and I was looking at where my money comes from, and it's all over. I still get money from trade publications, which generally comes in the form of advances and you know, royalties, obviously, and advances are usually more significant than royalties, because you have to earn out the advance to get the royalty. But that's an important part of it. In Australia, we have a really nice public lending rights scheme, an educational lending rights scheme. So every time one of your books gets borrowed from a library, or you know, taken out of or picked up in a school or something like that, you'll get something equivalent to, you know, a standard commercial royalty payment on it. So that's not something it is something you have to do. There's a form you have to fill out each year, and you make sure that, you know, your ISBNs and everything are right. You know, I advise anybody who's got anything in print in Australia to do that, because it can be quite significant the amount of money which comes in. I have experimented the past 6 months quite successfully with a private column. I've always written columns for newspapers and magazines. It's a type of writing that I enjoy doing. And it's a type of writing that traditionally, you know, working writers have done. If you look at some of the great columnists in the UK, they would probably consider themselves novelists first. They just happen to have a, you know, an interesting column in the, you know, Spectator or Punch or something like that. And so I've always done that, but you know, media has, it's had a much tougher time of it than book publishing. And for a long time, I have been planning not to get out of media because I love it as a business, but to basically prepare for the day that it's not there anymore, because that day is probably coming in the next 5 to 10 years. So I do that. I do some speaking gigs. It's not something I go looking for, but if you put yourself out there, particularly if you're doing nonfiction work, it's something we haven't touched on tonight, but you know, there are great opportunities for publishing in the nonfiction area, and with that comes the opportunity to do selling, sorry, to do speaking gigs. And in fact, a lot of people basically publish the books almost as giveaways to build up their speaking business. But that is, you know, that's a whole other podcast. You can probably get someone else to talk about that. Where else do I get my money from? I still do a fair amount of freelancing. I don't go looking for it now. I used to, when I was a younger writer, I used to put aside a day every month, and I would just walk around Sydney, which is where I was based in those days, and I would go from, you know, Playboy to Rolling Stone to, you know, Inside Sport, which is a big sporting magazine. I'd visit the editors, and we'd have a, you know, cup of tea and a chat about, you know, what I might like to write. And it was all very sort of old fashioned and old world and fantastic. But I don't do it anymore because that business is it's on the way out.
Yeah.
But honest to God, Joanna, looking forward to the next 10 or 15 years, most of my income is going to come from self-published books.
Wow. It's been so interesting to talk to you. And it's a really great sort of roundup of the changes in publishing and how your career has changed over time as well. So super exciting. So where can people find you and your books online?
Well, they can find me on Twitter. I'm trying to spend less time there, but you know, I'm hopeless. I'm addicted. So I'm at John Birmingham on Twitter. I have a blog, which I haven't done much on the past couple of months because I was looking after my dad, who was very sick, and had a few books to do as well. But I'm about to start cranking that up again. So that is cheeseburgergothic.com. And if, you know, they want to join my book club, which is what I call my mailing list because it sounds less, you know, sort of needy, that is at jbismymasternow.com.
And your writing is very funny. So I advise people to check out all your books. You have so many books, and we didn't even talk about your thrillers or, you know, your nonfiction. And yeah, so you just have so many books. It's amazing. So definitely check out John. So thanks so much for your time. That was fantastic.
Thanks for having me, man.
So I hope you enjoyed the conversation with John Birmingham. It certainly made me feel really content with my writing career choices. So next week, I'm talking to the lovely Sarah Painter about the worried writer, how to tackle the fears and self-doubts which we all have about our writing. And you've obviously heard some more about mine lately with the Thriller Fest show a few weeks ago, and we'll be getting more into the psychological side of being a writer next week. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.